Anyway, okay, I'll stand here and speak. Thank you, Stephen. Can I thank Philip Matthews for helping organize this, and thank ISIS for making this possible as well. I also like to recognize Tran Sri Yuen, who many of you might know is a distinguished Malaysian who has taken his time to come here today, so thank you. And I recommend everyone reads his book, which I think, if I'm not mistaken, is called Country Before Self.
Nation
Before Self. So all the complaining Malaysians, please read the book first before complaining. Do something. Okay. What I'm going to say typically makes me an instant pariah. So I'd ask you all to be a bit tolerant. I have about half an hour to say what I have to say. So I might generalize, and I hope you will all tolerate some of my excesses. But it is to start the conversation. I hope when I leave, you will treat me more like a mongrel than a pariah. And what I have to say makes me a pariah usually only because we've all become sort of pedigrees in terms of our denial. So keep your kind of pedigrees, try and please tolerate me. I'm sometimes accused of slaying cows in front of Brahmins. So if there are any Brahmins here, please no jihad. Okay, let me off lightly. I thought I'd sort of talk for about 30 minutes. Some of you who know me know that it's usually difficult to stop me, but I'll try and be disciplined. And maybe segment it into three, four parts. The first one is why I wrote the book. Secondly, what the book says. And lastly, perhaps say a few things about how Malaysia might do things slightly differently. And I hope the media will pick up on it, but I don't go to jail or anything. So I'll try and cover those issues. Now, what triggered the book was an understanding of a feeling over the last, particularly last 15 years, and the last 10 years in particularly, that much of the conversation about this word called environment and sustainability was becoming stupider by the day. I felt that we had now embarked on a journey to talk about environment that you can just go on your Facebook and say, I care, and you've done your bit. You can go on Twitter, or is it called Twitter? Twitter, and you can do things, and then you're cool. And everyone's caring, but actually no one's doing anything. And even worse was the fact that it apparently became clear that now the world's problems will be solved by companies. That somehow governments can abdicate responsibilities and somehow great multinational companies will solve public issues. And so we have the sustainability agenda becoming part of corporate speak. By the way, I'm very corporate, so don't get me wrong. I'm not a Greenpeace advocate, etc. But the narrative was essentially being dumbed down. And there was a reason for it, because there was a need to preserve the way things were being done, and an economic model that essentially seeks to undermine and underprice resources. And I thought there was a need to slightly change this narrative and try and bring a different discourse. So if you know that almost every company has got a sustainability report, usually with a tree, a dolphin, and then blue sky. You know that report? Yeah? Okay. And then some children hugging it and running in green fields. When I'm more cheeky, I say even the U.S. Army now apparently has a sustainability report. I don't know what that means. Maybe it's a carbon neutral Guantanamo Bay. But that's where the narrative is gone, okay? Completely dumbing down, in denial, etc. So I thought, could I bring a different discussion? Particularly because in Asia, we, having become intellectually submissive and intellectually subservient, were buying all this stuff. So if Thomas Friedman said the world is flat and mobile phones are going to save the world and every Indian kid without a toilet is going to have a computer, we said right on. We said this must be good. They can have computers but no toilets. And this would somehow make the world better. And they would all talk to each other. They would all be connected. And I thought this is something I have to see if I could mainstream a taboo subject. The taboo being that we are in denial. that essentially the idea that technology, free markets, and finance will solve the problems of constraints is a lie. And we need to put a pin in the balloon of that lie. It's a massive lie, and we should address these issues. So I would like to start my piece I wrote about 3-4 weeks ago in the Financial Times called "We Don't Need an Asian Century." You will all know and be aware that more and more as economic power has shifted from the West to the East, we Asians have all started to feel, hey, this is our time. Now we are going to be the lords. The decline of the financial markets in the West, in the Europeans, the problems in the Eurozone, etc., means we are going to be king. Well, we are actually just postponing the inevitable. And my view was that all talk of an Asian century needs to be reframed. For one simple reason, if you look at how the last two centuries were, the talk of the 19th century, I think, was called the British century, right? Well, we should all know in Malaysia. It was called the 19th century, the British century. But what was the British century? And please don't get me wrong, this is not a rant against the West. Some people jump to the conclusion that I'm anti-European, white people. I mean, some of my best people, friends are Americans, okay? So this is not anti-West or pro-East. In fact, if anything, it's a challenge to Asian business and political leaders to wake up from their intellectual subservience and to say, where does this part of the world go in the next 50 years? But the centuries of the British century was essentially one of exceptionalism. And clearly there was no bigger exhibition of exceptionalism than the latter half of the 20th century, which was the American century. All of these sort of centuries were essentially based on the need to access resources. I mean, the Brits didn't go to India because they liked vindaloo curry powder and stuff like that. I mean, they went to the UK, to India, because they needed resources, then the spice trade, etc. At the end of the British Empire in India, 20,000 Brits ruled 350 million Indians. Great business model. Okay? And then we went and refined that in the business schools, how to outsource and manage. So I said the Asian century would be a very bad idea if it was a replication of that exceptionalism, essentially saying China and India, the giants of Asia, would essentially now rule the world through the same models of extractive, exploitative management of resources. Ultimately, the productivity of economies is based on not what, you know, your iPad tells you, but how the iPad is made and how we create things through the use of resources. So I argue that we have a crisis of capitalism, and the crisis of capitalism is rooted in three things, which is the core of my argument in my book. One, the first one is that capitalism hinges on the need to promote relentless consumption. The need to buy one, get one free. Voodoo economics. The need to tell you that if you've got one, come on, you can have another. Go to the shopping mall. If you have one roti chana, you can have another one because we'll give you a discount. Okay, relentless promotion of consumption. And we all know that we are victims of that. As consumers, most of us are mindless. We are seduced by the desire to consume more, which panders to the lowest common denominator in human behavior. So it relies on that. Secondly, it does that, the buy one, get one free, by seeking to underprice resources. You can't do this without underpricing resources, constantly looking to get things for free. Closer to home, palm oil is a great example of how we essentially seek to produce fatty foods, cookies, chocolates, etc., by underpricing the resource base. And you can all look at how this works. But the price of cookies has never gone up, it's gone down, because we have underpriced our rainforests and all of those other things that are related to the desire to produce more cheap, fatty foods. And this is not a greening discussion, so please, I live in Hong Kong, I'm a capitalist, I pay the rents there, so please don't think I belong to some fringe group, okay? But this is really about the future of capitalism. So it seeks to promote relentless consumption, it seeks to underprice resources. Now, very importantly, when you seek to underprice resources, what does capitalism do? under price resources, it needs to fight regulation. It has to fight regulation. Because the state, which is meant to protect public good, protect common interest, has to, the only way to do that is to impose regulation, be it air quality, water, consumption tax, etc., be it whether this thing should be recycled or whether we should ban this altogether. The companies fight this relentlessly. So it seeks to undermine regulation. Working as a consultant for 20 years, I've seen the belly of the beast. The companies fight. The one time I could walk into the CEO's office of any large multinational when they had a regulation coming up and they wanted consultants to fight it. And of course, there's the other cohort of people, the lawyers, the tax consultants, and all of these people who fight regulation. I'm not saying they're evil. It's just how it works. So ultimately, if you want to fight regulation, you do one thing. You usurp the state. You take it over. You weaken it. So what's happened in a way is much of the role of the state has been undermined, and many politicians these days feel they need to abdicate their responsibility. I've been to so many policy conventions, etc., and there's nothing better that policymakers like than some multinational CEO saying, we can solve your problem with our products and our technology. And then the politicians say, hey, great. And then not only that, you get invited to the cocktails that the multinationals hold, and you can also get invited to the White House and the World Economic Forum. But say anything else and you don't get invited. So this narrative has become very, very bizarre. And we all know this is true. And I thought when I was 2 years ago that I should write this book, because more and more as I spoke about this thing, privately everyone came to me and said, hey, Tendon, you're right. I said, why don't you say something? Oh, they can't. And particularly in this part of our world, politicians and CEOs who agree with what I'm saying will never say this publicly for a couple of reasons. One, they seek legitimacy through association with Western institutions. You don't get onto the Harvard board by challenging the Harvard business model of externalizing two costs through supply chains, which is what the Apple story is all about. The Apple story is all about how can you screw Chinese workers and externalize costs and make this fancy product and sell it for $500. What is the true price of an iPad? Anyone want to guess? I would suggest it's about $10,000. And I'd like some business school to prove me wrong by launching 1,000 PhDs to look at the true price. What is the price of a hamburger in Malaysia? No, not the guys on the street and in the McDonald's, right? How much is it? About 8 ringgit? So maybe about $2.5. I would argue it's about $50 if you put in the true price. I mean, that's the extreme cost. But therefore, we should be looking at the true cost of products and services. But you're not going to get McDonald's trying to launch 1,000 PhDs on the true price of the meat that goes in, the corn that produces the meat, the water that goes into producing that meat very inefficiently, and the carbon footprint. So that's the point I'm trying to make. So let us look at the last 4 years and really what happened to make very clear this issue. In about 2008, you will all know we had the financial crisis, yes? So what happened during the financial crisis when there was real fear in the Western world that the entire financial architecture was collapsing? Do you all remember? I think we were being told in Asia, you laggards who save, please start consuming. Do you remember? Yeah, please don't save. Please buy more things that you don't even need. Had two. And so we were told, please buy. And who were told the most? The Chinese and the Indians. And of course the Chinese and the Indians suddenly felt, hey, you see, after 200-300 years of being under sort of imperial control or whatever, now we are in charge. They have come to us. So the Indians felt him and great. They went and bought Jaguar, the company. Right? You can't drive a Jaguar in most Indian cities. But you know, so we all felt great. We are now in charge. The Americans and the Europeans have come to us to say, please consume more so that we can rebalance the global economy. You all remember this, yeah? And then we thought this is our Asian century. At the same time, in 2009, you will all remember that there was a run-up to the climate change conference in Copenhagen. What were we told then? Hey, you Chinese, you Indians, you Asians, please stop your emissions. Reduce. Do you remember? The Chinese were the worst, they were taught. Why? It's very easy, because you can bash, you know, communist types, you know. You can't bash the good Indian Democrats. Though the Indian emissions were actually, Indians were probably the biggest spoilers at Copenhagen than the Chinese. The Chinese came with the plan, the Indians came to talk, right? And the Indians did that very well. The Chinese speaking to translators, you get lost in translation, and so the Chinese, you guys Chinese communists, very bad people, etc. So the Chinese got very upset. But the Chinese were the only ones that actually came with a plan for 17% reduction on energy efficiency, etc. So, but if you were a thinking person, you would think, So I was trying to think a bit at this time. I was thinking, how come we're being told to consume more, and at the same time we're being told to reduce our emissions? Now, if you've got a bit of a technical background, and I have a little bit, I know this is mumbo-jumbo. There's no way that 3.5 billion Asians being encouraged to live American lifestyles can reduce emissions. There's no chance. So we are being told to rebalance the global economy, be good global citizens to reset the balance sheet of Goldman Sachs. And then on the other hand, we're being told, you must be responsible citizens to reduce your emissions. Not possible. I wondered, why isn't anyone talking about this? So I read that pink paper called the Financial Times. Front page, rebalance the global economy. Asians must consume. Why are the Japanese being better consumers? The Chinese, the Indians, all of these people. And then on page 3, there is climate change. The greatest challenge to human survival. And we must reduce emissions. And my God, those Asians don't understand. They don't want to sign up. So complete disconnect. We need to do something different. So I said, we have to do something different. Now, let me give 2 examples of why the disconnect is so massive, and then I'll try and finish off with a few remarks about what I think need to be done. Because talking about it is something, what are the things that need to be done? The first one is, let's take cars. Most of you have been to Asian cities, yes? How many of you have traveled? Most people have traveled. I think you will all agree with me, and I try and exclude KL from this, but you'll all agree with me that we need more cars in Asian cities, like I need a hole in my head. True? Yet why are we being told, please, Asians, buy more cars? This is your God-given right. In fact, this is even your human right, to own a car. But car ownership is not a human right. But try saying that in America. Right? Try saying that in America. I say this in America and they think I'm undercover Taliban. Okay? I don't understand freedom. Okay? But we can't have more cars. But we are told more cars. Some stats. China today is the world's largest car market. Anyone want to guess how many cars per 1,000 people in China? The OECD car ownership levels are 750 cars per 1,000 people, OECD countries. China? Anyone? About 150, the world's largest car market. Anyone been to Beijing in the last year? You will know what I'm talking about, okay? India, anyone want to guess what the car ownership levels are? About 50, 35 actually. Yet you will know that most Indian cities do not need more cars, right? But I think the Indian government has a plan, just bad roads. All right, so no more cars. Okay, it's not a McKinsey strategy, it's an Indian government strategy. But my point is that we can't have more cars. Now, if we aspire, which we are told is a God-given right, you know, irrespective of which God you believe in, you know how many cars there will be in the world by 2050? 4 billion, my friends. 4 billion cars. This is not possible. All the oil in the world will be used to just drive cars. 4 billion cars. Now, what are we being told about this dilemma? Magic. We will have green cars. This is pure fiction. This is Star Trek Plus. Make the movie, okay? This will not happen. I won't go into the details of why we can't have cars, but I'm very pleased that the director here wrote a piece saying Malaysians should do more BMW, right? More buses, more MRTs, and more walking, all right? But we need a strong state. I'll come to why I believe we need a strong state to do that. But BMW, not the Bavarian type, but the buses, the walking, and the MRTs. So we're told more cars. This is not possible. There's no conversation about this. There's a conversation that somehow we will fix this problem. This is nonsense. This is a lie. And we need to do something about it. One more example is meat. just before lunch, I just tried to toughen meat a bit. Meat consumption, okay? Today, 350 million Americans consume about 9 billion birds. This includes turkeys, Christmas, all of that, you know? 9 billion birds. 3.5 billion Asians, 10 times the population today, consumes about 16 billion birds. Just 50% more birds. About 50% more. What happens when we get richer and we follow an economic model which essentially allows you to have more birds under price through vaccines and all kinds of steroids, etc.? We will all soon be eating more birds. I mean, just look at Malaysia consumption. I have some statistics here in terms of food imports, etc. Staggering, okay? Now, if we do what is the trajectory, and believe me, the meat industry will make sure you have your bird, okay? And no price increase. Because if the price increases, then we all riot because we think we have a right to more birds, and then the government say, oops, sorry, let's keep the prices down, let's have more birds. Well, if we all eat more birds, then in Asia, and we aspire to live like, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken type of lifestyles, which we've all been promoted since for 40 years, you know how many birds we will eat by 2050? 120 billion birds. Now, I have no idea what this looks like. But sometimes at night I get up with a sweat, I imagine there's a bird god, and the bird god releases all the birds on the same day, and all the airports will be closed, the sun will be blocked off, and planes will be crashing because there's so many birds. Now this is not possible. I won't go into the details why this is not possible, but it's just understand that meat production today is essentially an industrial process. It depends on essentially mass, vast streams of genetically modified foods, large amount of vaccines, steroids, etc. Farm to gate for chickens about 30, 40 years ago in China, and I bet in Malaysia too, used to be up for chicken, for egg to, you know, your piece of ayam goreng, used to be maybe about 75 days. Today it's about 30. Okay, chemicalized food. And there's huge implications of how this happens. So if we start consuming those levels of meat, the world will be rocked. This is simply not possible. So I could go on about everything from iPads to phones, etc., about the underpricing to create the demand so that we can all continue to consume to sustain an economic model that relentlessly needs you to have more than you need. Okay, and one other indication of this underpricing is in Asia today we have more people with access to mobile phones than toilets. I don't know how you think about that, but that usually makes me feel slightly constipated. Okay, more mobile phones than toilets. How did the mobile phone become an ubiquitous, throwaway, free for all, and the toilet a luxury item? So I would imagine, and I don't want to, you know, poke too much fun at my Indian brothers and sisters, but I have this image of a movie in which the Indian IT geeks will all be walking around in Bangalore with their GPSs trying to locate the only sanitary toilets. Okay? Now that would be a hit better than Slumdog Millionaire. But more seriously, this is a massive problem. And my point I'm trying to make is that the mobile phone has basically become a free commodity through the underpricing of an economic model. Today I can go in Hong Kong and get a phone, it's even called a BlackBerry, for free. I go and see my friend Mr. Lee, and he says, you want a phone? Okay, this is for free. Just sign up for a 3-year contract. So it's a service idea, and the phone's for free. But you all know that the mobile phone is an extremely high piece of technology. Compressed hydrocarbons, and of course a lot of rare metals and earth. This is an expensive piece of gadget. This should never be for free. But the model allows you to make it in China, underprice all the externalities, and give it to everyone for free. And of course 3 months later they call me and say, do you want to upgrade? Right? They got your phone number anyway. And that's the pricing mechanism. So what I'm suggesting now that we need to connect the dots in Asia and understand two things. How much time do I have?
You have 10 minutes.
Okay, now 10 minutes. We need to connect the dots and understand a couple of things. In 2050, the world's population will be about 9.5 billion, 10 billion, give or take 100 million, you know, because there's a lot of people, you can't count them all. about 10 billion people. About 6 billion will be living in this part of the world. 6 billion. 6 billion. Western Asians cannot and should not aspire to live the Western lifestyle, and particularly the American lifestyle. That golden age of excessive consumption and privilege is over. We need to define a new era of how do we organize ourselves and live together in more equitable ways. And I'm not going to use a fluffy word, sustainable, because then you'll think I'm some kind of Greenpeace hippie, you know, vegetarian, eating granola and yogurt for breakfast, etc. But most seriously, how do we organize ourselves? So 5-6 billion Asians in 2050 cannot live like Americans. What do we do? We'll have to do things very, very differently. And I suggest that we need to take into consideration a couple of very important things. The first one is that today Asia's GDP is, and I assume there's some economists here, it's about $30 trillion. The global economy is about $70 trillion. That is expected to grow to $420 trillion by 2050, and Asia's part of that GDP about 50%, $230 trillion. Right? Now, in terms of resource intensity per unit of GDP today, the UN and lots of scientific work is being done to suggest that if we are to have a more sustainable society, meaning one in which we don't have catastrophic meltdown of the resource base and therefore, most importantly, social inequity, which will create social chaos, then we will need to reduce our resource intensity that we now take for granted by 80%. We will need to reduce resource intensity, not by 5% or 10%, by 80% to attain a more sustainable social economic model. This no country has even achieved, right? What we get, though, is more discussions that somehow we will innovate. You all remember that word? Go to any business conference, any political conference, and everyone wants to use the word innovation. Ask them to spell out. Even spell the word, if I'm getting it wrong, but I'll have to spell out what it actually means, and particularly those suspects from the business schools. But they have no idea. But it's become a holy grail word. You just say innovation, and then everyone nods. Yeah, okay. Don't ask any more questions. It's the escape route to we will make something. Because the belief is somehow that human ingenuity will solve all of these problems. There is no need for limits or constraints. There's no need for sacrifice. We can all have everything because the individual is king. And frankly, the individual cannot be king in 2050. So I argue, therefore, that we will need to do three things. The first one is to start by making a very bold policy decision that all policies must be framed under the idea of resource constraints. Now, some of you might think, oh, this is an environmental thing. Please believe me, this is a political discussion. This has nothing to do with the environment. One of the problems we've had with the green groups, etc., they all complain. And therefore, it's been very easy for politicians and businesses to sideline them as irrelevant because they're just angry, apparently. Usually they think they're angry, they must be poor, you know, they must be misguided, etc. They don't have proper jobs. You know that kind of thing. So it's easy to dismantle. But bring them to the conference when we want to feel good over lunch, and there'll be a green talk and everything's okay. So I think, you know, the wording is also important. We need to get rid of terms like greening. This is sort of juvenile. Because greening allows us to sort of escape the true discussion about constraints and political needs. I've argued that greening is a public relations terminology invented by the PR industry. If the PR industry existed during the times of slavery, then they called slaves guest workers. Okay, then they said they said guests. Okay, and slavery in a way was the first attempt to underprice resources for the mobilization of profits. And then slavery became uncool. You can't take black people on boats from Africa, etc. So then slavery was there. Then we had the colonies. And then when natives got restless, then we had freedom. But the problem was when the natives got restless and they became free, the elite amongst the natives said, I don't want you in charge, but I want to be like you. And so we copied the same models because we had no narrative of our own. And all I'm trying to do is say we need to have a new narrative in our universities, etc. Much smarter people need to define what that story looks like. So place resource management not as an environmental agenda, but right at the center of all policy making. Because I think you will not understand, all our existences depend on the productivity of natural systems. So this is not some hippie talk, okay? This is productivity depends on natural systems. Under that, three cornerstones of the policy. The first one is that if resources are constrained, then economic activity needs to be subservient to maintaining the vitality of the resource base. So I'm not talking about just conservation, it's maintaining the vitality. Since my time is up, I will kind of run through very quickly. Secondly, if we are to make, if resources are to be equitably spread across economies and across intergenerations, then we have to understand that collective welfare takes precedence over individual rights. So this flies in the face of the liberal Western narrative where the individual is king. Let me give you one example. The right of the individual in this part of the world to buy a car is a can create a collective nightmare. So we need to put collective welfare ahead of the individual's right to exercise it. And that is a social contract which we need a new discourse around. But this, whenever I say this in China, I'm a hero, but when I say this in the West, they immediately say, oh, you must be a member of the Chinese Communist Party. I've applied, but I haven't got the papers yet. But what I'm saying, though, is that you understand my point. The collective interest becomes a very different discussion. And my last point is that if resources are to be utilized fairly, then we will need to reprice them. And in repricing them, we need to challenge one of the main tenets of current economic orthodoxy, which is that productivity is measured around how we use resources rather than how we use people. Quick example, okay? So today, productivity gains are measured by how you displace people, right? Put in 5 computers and take away 50 people. And this is seen as innovation. This is what the business schools teach you. So in China, Foxconn, the people who make your iPad and underprice it, have decided that, you know, people are too troublesome. You know, they're jumping off buildings, falling on nets, and then the Apple CEO comes and says, oh, sorry, we'll raise your salary by 2 times because we care. Foxconn have decided that this is too difficult. So they want to replace, because the price of capital in China is now cheaper than the price of labor. Again, voodoo economics, of course, but, you know, someone's written a paper at Wharton or somewhere around this. And so they want to replace people with robots. So Foxconn are going to have, apparently, 1 million robots by 2015 to make your toys, your little gadgets, okay? Now, you tell me, what kind of economic model suggests that in a country with 1.3 billion people, where people need to work, we need robots? You tell me. But that's the economic model we live in. Now, in Japan, I have some very interesting friends where robots are becoming much more important. And in some situations, they are necessary. So I'm not against technology. But in Japan now, because of the demographics of old age, robots play an important part, particularly for the elderly. But in Japan, I found out last week in Tokyo, something really interesting. They have factories where robots are making robots. So, Star Trek, okay? But robots making robots, they don't need lights at night, okay? So very interesting. So productivity needs to be changed completely for the simple reason. Productivity measured around how do we displace people to use maximum resources is not our dilemma anymore. Our dilemma is the complete opposite one. Lots of people, we need productive work, limited resources. So how would you logically measure productivity? You measure productivity around the basis of how do we put as many people to work, yes, and use as few resources as possible. And I can go into that a bit more, but that's why the book is on sale outside. So please, sorry. I think I'll finish by saying that I therefore argue that we need to reject the Western narrative, which I think has become infectious because it's so seductive. It's not wrong, it's past itself by date. What is happening in the US and Europe is, in my view, the tip of the iceberg in the end of 300 years of was essentially exploitative, extractive, and externalizing growth models. That doesn't make it bad or evil or whatever. It's just a different time. We need to do something different. And to do that, finally, I would say, we need a strong state. A state that is able to essentially dictate, and I use the word dictate, what are the draconian measures that we will need to put in place if we are to create more legitimate societies in which access to resources is the fundamental human right, rather than the right to protest in, I can't say KL, Tiananmen Square, okay, or wherever, okay? That's more important. My final part about Malaysia would be that, in a way, we are a very lucky lot. And our luckiness is perhaps where that has made us so complacent. We live in a very resource-rich country. We are all young members of a very rich resource base. We have lived extraordinary lives in terms of the wealth that we have created, though many of us still complain. Car ownership levels in Malaysia, in terms of Asia, are only second to Japan. Still low relative to the OECD levels, but we have created a huge amount of problems. But I ask you to look at where those problems come from. If I look at diets, Malaysia has probably got the highest rate of diabetes in Asia, next to India. Obesity is a massive problem that is increasing all the time. And clearly, if you look at even the very popular rare earth plant in Kuantan, essentially, these are all an economic model which makes it cheaper to build these things in third world countries. But I thought we were not a third world country. I thought we were aspiring to be, is it first world? I think we paid a down payment on the second world, and now we're trying to go to the first world, right? So we need to decide, it's not an environmental issue, it's really which economic model, what type of society we want. The guys at Linus are not bad, they're just Australian to understand that the economic model doesn't allow them to put that plant in Aboriginal land in Australia, because that'd be a ruckus. Here, they thought, we can sneak in. But the Malaysians were all sleeping on Teh Tarik for 5 years, suddenly woke up last year. They said, oh, what happened here? And that's the issue, and we need to be extremely organized in how we have a more intelligent debate beyond the environment around an economic model. It's really a question of what kind of country do we want to be. Do we want to be a first world country? Well, no world first world country has this sort of plant. But if we want to be a third world country, please welcome it, embrace it, have it in the media. But we need to decide. But the model is of externalizing costs. That's why it's not in Australia, neither is it in California. And the Chinese, as you all know, have decided that they are going to clamp down on these plants because they have found out, firstly, it was too cheap. Secondly, too cheap because all the externalities were in China. Now they're going to put a true cost to it. And what happens? The Chinese get taken to WTO for this. So I'll end by saying that our political systems essentially reflect our rent-seeking needs. And whether it's cows or condominiums or, you know, whatever, right? And it goes beyond race and religion and ethnicity, which we seem to be bogged down in. It's essentially an economic model where rent seekers seek to take advantage and then they usurp the political systems. And that is our biggest challenge. And we need to move beyond the race dialogue. Because fundamentally, that's what it's about. So thank you very much.